Thank you so much, Jessica. That was just beautiful, as always. Thank you. Are you the only harpist who raps? You're the only one I know who does, so it's really very, very cool, very endearing. Well, great to see you, even if I can't see you. It's great to see you. I'm talking today about Dharma, of course, and Dharma we're defining based on the definitions in the book that we're reading, The Great Work of Your Life by Stephen Cope. He defines Dharma as your sacred calling, and he says that everybody has a Dharma, but that sometimes it's a little difficult to discern your Dharma, and even if we discern it, sometimes we are just collapsed in doubt about what our Dharma truly is. The book is actually a teaching on the Bhagavad Gita, which is a Hindu scripture. It's based on the relationship between Arjuna, who is a great warrior, and Krishna, Lord Krishna, who is his charioteer in disguise. I believe Lord Krishna is up there. You may not be able to see him around the harp, but he's there playing the flute next to my dog Saraswati, dressed as a nun, and Richard Rohr on the other side. But anyway, Krishna is posing as the charioteer, but he's also getting his message over to Arjuna, because Arjuna has this huge conflict. I'm just giving you the cliff notes here. He's supposed to be fighting in a just war against some of his loved ones, and he just doesn't want to. He's afraid. He knows it's his calling, but he's afraid, so he collapses in doubt. And Arjuna then goes and gives a lengthy treatise on the power of Dharma, sacred calling, to invite us into a greater expression of ourselves and doing the work that not only serves the evolution of our lives, but that serves the evolution of all of humanity, of the whole world, not only humanity, but the rocks and the trees and the animal kingdom and the oceans and all of that. So that's what the book is about. And you know, I think that some of us may be like Arjuna. We either don't know what our sacred calling, our Dharma is, and if we do have an inkling about it, if we have a little thought about what it might be, it often feels like it's somehow not good enough, or we're afraid to start, or maybe it feels too big, or maybe it feels too little. And so Krishna offers four pillars of working with our Dharma, working with our sacred calling, and we are working with the first pillar today, which is to inhabit your Dharma, to say yes to your Dharma. That's not exactly how he said it. Look to your Dharma. Look to your Dharma is what he said. And he gives us three ways to do that. He says that we can trust in the gift of Dharma, trust in the gift of our calling. We can also respond to the calling of the time around us, the time and the essence of what life is around us, the conditions of the world, and that we also are called to trust that the small isn't really small. So we'll be addressing this today in whatever way comes up. The first thing I want to go back to, though, the idea that some of us feel like, you know, maybe when God was handing out Dharma, we didn't get one. There's one for you, there's one for you. Skip that one. One for you over there. I'm going to assume that everybody here that I'm speaking to, everybody in the virtual world and here in person, that everybody here has a fingerprint, at least one. Right? And everybody's fingerprint is unique. Again, to anthropomorphize God, it's not like he's like, okay, this guy has this fingerprints, this lady has this fingerprints. Ah, oh, I'm all out of fingerprints. I don't know what to do with this one. I've used up all my fingerprint ideas. Not true. Not going to happen. We all have a fingerprint, and in the book, Stephen Cope, the author of this book, says that science is revealing that our brain cells are unique, and therefore our nervous systems are unique, and our bodies are all unique, and we each have a different place in that puzzle, and that we each have a sacred calling, where our sacred calling, nothing is impossible for our sacred calling, and we all are complete individuals in heart, mind, body, brain, and being. And that our Dharma is the same thing. It is like an individual fingerprint for the soul. So if you are alive, you have a Dharma. You just may not know what it is. One of the ways to know what your Dharma might be is to trust in the gift. That's the first thing that we're going to talk about today, is trusting in the gift. Probably, when a lot of us were children, we had things that we loved to do, things that made us happy, things that filled us with joy, things that inspired us. And in the context of childhood, we may not have recognized how important all of that was. And also, we may not have had parents that would mirror that back to us, mirror back the look that they saw on our faces when we were doing something that was really magnificent. You know, I know that often our parents mean well, sometimes they don't, but often our parents mean well. But I remember, you know, I played the piano incessantly, and my mother, I used to play Havana Gila on the piano incessantly, and my mother's comment about that was, you know, I think maybe you were Jewish in a former life, because we've heard a lot of Havana Gila. And I remember my father, when I decided to go to music school, this was after I had gotten a practical job being a nurse, and my father was like, oh my God, I overheard him talking to my sister, what is she up to now? She's going to music school, she's going to ruin her life. And so often our parents, right? Huh? Yeah. Often our parents have really, really good intentions for us. They want to protect us, but they don't necessarily mirror back what our soul's calling is. So sometimes we have to discover that at a later age. Now, in the book, it tells a story about somebody whose soul's calling was mirrored back to her and the effect that it had on her. He's in this book, The Great Work of Your Life. Stephen Cope does a beautiful job of picking people that we've probably all heard of and seeing how the great work of their life evolved in them, how their Dharma evolved in them. And he also talks about regular, ordinary people, because everybody is both ordinary and extraordinary, but that's another talk. Anyway, he talks about Jane Goodall. Now, I'm assuming that pretty much everybody has heard of Jane Goodall, but just in case, she was somebody that was born into a wealthy environment. She was part of the aristocracy, so to speak, and she ended up being a completely devoted scientist to studying primates in Africa. And she changed the face of science in terms of our relationship with animals, that she recognized their soul and their intelligence, and she actually named the chimps that she studied, and she lived with a pack of chimps. She would spend the night with them, and she recognized that they engaged in pro-social behaviors, and that they made tools, and that they were highly intelligent, highly evolved beings. And it said in the book that she changed the way that we relate to the animal kingdom. And I feel that perhaps Jane Goodall is responsible for the fact that I never get a good night's sleep ever, because I have this pack of animals sleeping in my bed with me, that she helped us recognize that animals have souls and that dogs have rights too, dang it, and they need to sleep on the bed. But that, again, that's another story. Jane Goodall was an amazing woman, and part of the reason that she was so amazing, that she changed science, and that she changed the face of the world in terms of our relationship with animals, was that her love of animals was mirrored for her as a child. It said that when she was 18 months old, she used to dig up earthworms and take them to bed with her. Now, we have a lot of earthworms, and we have not gotten to that point yet. Just shared about the dogs and the cat, you know, but not the earthworms yet. But another story about Jane Goodall, when she was 4, she became very curious. She was always curious about the animal kingdom, and she became curious about where do chickens' eggs come from. I remember learning where babies come from, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me. That's not going to happen. My friend Elaine Gilligan said it came out of your belly button, which seemed to me more feasible, and then my mom told me where they... Okay. Maybe that's why I never had children. Anyway, so Jane Goodall became very fascinated with where chicken eggs came from. And she realized that when she went into the chicken house, into the hen house, to see where the chickens' eggs came from, that they would get scared and they wouldn't lay any eggs when she was there. So she hid in one of the chickens' little rooms, whatever they're called, roosts. And she hid there, and she was just a little tiny girl, and she hid there, and she waited there for hours. And in the meantime, her family was saying, where's Jane? Where's she at? Where'd she go? We can't find Jane. Oh my God, this is serious. And they were looking all over for her in frenzy, trying to find her. And there she was hiding in the chicken house. Well, when she was in the chicken house, she saw what happened. She saw a chicken, I won't demonstrate it. Oh, I have to, lay an egg. And she saw where it came out, and she picked up the egg, and she was fascinated, and she ran out of the chicken house and ran into her mother and said, look, you know where this came from, Mom? And her mother, instead of being upset that Jane had hidden for hours in the chicken house, it said that she responded to the shine in Jane's eyes, and she encouraged her to tell her story. Now, what kind of a mom is that? That's an amazing mom. And maybe not all of us had those parents, again, probably because they were concerned for us. They may not have recognized our gifts, or they may not have celebrated our gifts or cherished them or nourished them. Maybe a little, maybe a lot. But if we didn't have that mom, we can be that parent for ourselves. We can start to recognize what makes us come alive. What makes us come alive? What makes our eyes shine? And start to nourish that and nurture that and simply raise it up into the light and see what Spirit wants to do with that energy. Because I am convinced that, okay, I keep saying we have a Dharma. That's not quite accurate. I think a Dharma has us. And there is something magnificent that wants to express through every life, or we wouldn't be here. So we recognize our gifts, we nurture our gifts, we celebrate our gifts, and we raise them up into the light of Dharma to see what can be done through us. A really practical way that I've discovered how to do this is just a couple of things, but one is to look at peak experiences, like to look at your life and see what certain peak experiences were, and you may be surprised at what comes up. Don't put too much thought in it, but just write down or just in your mind, meditate on what some of your peak experiences were. You know, I was thinking about this the other day, and the first thing that popped into my head was singing at the Syrian border, singing a song that I knew, that I learned in college. All those Havana Gilas on the piano paid off because I knew about music and getting to work with people that I knew in India and reconciling the differences between the Muslim world and the former Christian world or the religious science world or whatever, and bringing all of the energy of the church into that moment. And that feels so Dharma-esque to me, feels so on purpose to me, because so much of what I like to do is to bring various divergent parts of myself and others together and reconcile all of it into something beautiful. And I know that if I had that experience, which was really just a fleeting moment in a long life, in a very long life, 62 years, if you can believe that, in 62 years, just bringing that experience into being and into consciousness just helped open my heart up to more dharmic experiences. And then everything starts to look like Dharma. Everything where you apply what you love starts to look like Dharma. So I strongly encourage, I don't like to boss anybody around, but this is the closest I'm going to get. I'm going to strongly encourage you to look at your life and look at what inspires you and look at what fills you with love and look at what fills you with light and look at what makes your eyes shine, and then just celebrate that and do it some more. And the other thing you can do is to be that place for others, to be that parent that perhaps others didn't have. So like if you see somebody doing something awesome, you could say, wow, Susan Burrell, you're an amazing prayer. And woohoo! And Hugh, what an amazing reading. And oh, over here, just incredible. All these musicians and Bill, that creativity, you know. Just start raising people's consciousness up about the gifts that they bring to the world. Because really, our Dharma is our gift to the world. It's to celebrate our gift in the world. So that is the first thing that we're talking about. Inhabit the gift, trust the gift, and celebrate the gift of who you are. The next thing is to recognize that small is not really small. Small can be big. You know, I always quote Joel Goldsmith, there is no up in infinity. There is no up, there is no down in infinity, and there is no small or large in infinity. Those are relative terms, and we have no idea how a small act can have a huge impact on the world. either positive or negative. So we stick to small positive acts that have a positive impact generations from now. Walt Whitman is the example that our friend Stephen Cope in this book uses as somebody who recognized, Henry David Thoreau is the example that Stephen Cope used for someone who recognized that small is important. Henry David Thoreau grew up in Concord, Massachusetts in the 1800s, and he wanted to be a writer. And I can imagine his parents, you know, going back to the idea of that our parents sometimes don't always, out of a protective nature, don't always support our gifts. Perhaps his mom and dad sat him down and he said, okay, son, you want to be a writer? Now, that's a really, really, really tough job. I don't know why I'm talking with a New York accent, but I am. Okay, that's a really tough job. So you're going to need to go to New York, and you're going to need to get in with all the other really good writers and, you know, build connections and work for them. And that's what he did. Minus the New York accent. I don't know where I channeled that from. I can't really do Boston, so, you know, New England. He can. But anyway, so he went to New York and he hung out with the writing glitterati, and he said he was just an abject failure. This is Henry David Thoreau, a household name that I would think most people have heard of, but he was just a failure. He couldn't get anything published. Nobody liked him. They didn't even like the way he looked. And so after trying to make a big splash in the world of writing, he decided to go back to Concord and move to Walden, where he had a pond, and his mother would bring him sandwiches and cookies, and he meditated for most of the day, and he took long walks, and he wrote beautiful, beautiful, beautiful words that many, many people know now. It says in the book that every college sophomore reads when they read Walden. And, you know, I quote him often when he says that he went to the woods to live deliberately. He downsized his life to do what was calling him, and it felt so much smaller than he, quote unquote, should be. But it led him to his true self, and it led him to what his soul wanted to express in the world. See, that's the thing. It's that should word, you know? I should be making a future for myself. I should be making a bigger future for myself. I should be famous, dang it. I should be celebrated. I should make a lot of money. Maybe, if that's your dharma, if that's your calling, but maybe not. I think the only should is that what it said in the reading is that you recognize that you should only be yourself and do what yourself longs to do in service of others. When our calling meets the service of others, that's when things take off. So for all of us, you know, how do we apply the wisdom of Thoreau to what we're doing? Well, again, I think it's that idea of trying to see where you are shooting yourself and letting go of that and saying, what is it that I really, really want to express? How do I want to express it? Asking the question, is small okay? And I'll tell you the answer to that question, small is okay. Because, you know, I've been doing this work for a long time, and so many times, you know, I say small is okay, and I'm like, yeah, right. I know it's embarrassing. I try and tell the truth as much as I can, but there, you know, I have doubt like anybody else. And, you know, I have seen the impact of the small on so many, many things. And again, when you start looking for it, you start to see the miraculous in the small. You know, I had the experience this past week. I pointed out my dog. You may not be able to see her around the heart, but my dog dressed as a nun, Saraswati, dressed as a nun with a Hindu goddess name, whatever, works in my house. But that she got sick last week. She got actually poisoned, and we took her to the vet, and she got the antidote, and it was significant blood loss, bleeding out, and just seeing the miracle of these little pills that we give her and them rebuilding her blood cells. It's just blood cells, invisible things that, you know, you could see the life force entering her body just by doing the right thing over and over and over again. And I thought, wow, this is happening in our house. This has got to be a metaphor for something greater than this. I mean, it's powerful just in itself, but to see the small impact of increasing blood cells bit by bit every single day, and how every day incrementally she's getting better and better and better. It's just a beautiful thing. So I think if we take that wisdom into ourselves and say, every day that I participate in the small acts of what I love, my life force, my red, metaphorical red blood cells, my energy begins to expand and I am lifted up into who I truly am meant to be. So again, not to be bossy, but I strongly encourage y'all and me to spend time every single day doing small things that are meaningful to you and feel how they connect you to your Dharma. And again, not only for you, but for others, seeing the small acts of goodness that others are doing that connect you to something greater and then telling them about it. My sister, who is she's a real nurse. I was a nurse for a little while. She's been a nurse for years, and she really knows a lot of stuff. And I was kind of problem-solving some of my dog's symptoms with her, and she wrote me a text. She said she was driving when we were talking, and she went home, and she did all of this research for me, and she wrote me a text that was this long. And just for me to see that she had taken the time to do that and that she had problem-solved all of these symptoms and was offering me this heartfelt advice that I had asked for just was so meaningful to me. So then I got to call her out in front of all my other sisters and say what a wonderful thing she had done. And then it started this spiral of goodness among the four of us that was just so beautiful, and it started radiating out to others as well. So you see, that's how it works. Is that beautiful or what? Am I right about this? Please, am I right? If you're at home, right. She is right. Yes, Reverend Bonnie is right. Absolutely. Dang it. I hardly ever get to say that, but I think I am right. Okay, the last point about how to gain access to what your Dharma truly is and to live from a place of Dharma is to listen to the times. Listen to the calling, to the voice of the times. Not the newspaper, but the times of that we live in, the era that we live in. You know, the example that Brother Stephen Cope used in his book was listening to the voice of the times during the Civil War. And this is where Walt Whitman fits in, Walt Whitman. Probably many of us have heard of Walt Whitman. He is a prolific writer, poet, and evidently he was a bit of a renegade in his time. He was a bit of a rogue, and some of his writing was a little too metaphysical for normal consumption. Perhaps some of us can relate to that, that sometimes we're a little too metaphysical for normal consumption. But anyway, he wrote one of his famous works and got some fame for it, a little bit of notoriety too. And and then it was during the Civil War, and everybody was, of course, scanning the papers to find out if any of their loved ones had died. And they thought, he and his family thought that his brother had died. And so it said that Walt Whitman took the $50, that was the family's entire savings, $50, and went on a pilgrimage to see if he could find his brother, to find out if he had died or to find out if he was still alive. And he started going into hospitals and in the Union Army, and he started going into those hospitals. And finally, he found that his brother was alive and well and seemed to have like a, you know, a golden umbrella around him where he wasn't hurt by anything. He had been in a whole bunch of battles and was okay. But in his journey through the hospitals, he said that he found what was his true calling at that time. Sure, he was a writer, and that was part of his calling, but the times were demanding something different of him. The times were demanding that he go to these hospitals and he sit with these young men who were sick and dying, who needed help, who needed water, who needed someone to give them attention, who needed someone to read to them, who needed someone to listen to them, who needed someone to write letters for them. And he did that for hours a day, for quite a long time. He did that for hours and hours. And he said that he gave these boys his time and attention, and they gave him everything. That's a beautiful thing. You may have noticed that the voice of the times right now is a bit raucous. It's a bit confusing, convoluted. The general consensus is that much of it is false narrative. And so we listen to that voice and we allow it to call up our Dharma in response to that voice. You know, what it says to me with the pandemic and election and civil unrest and all of these things that are going on, not only here, by the way, it's really all over the world, all of these things. What it brings up for me is, you know what? God is greater. And God is in each of us. And the goodness, the Dharma, the purpose in each of us is stronger than any falsehood that the world can drum up. This falsehood that we're separate. This falsehood that we're not alike, this falsehood that we are supposed to argue with each other, this falsehood that emotions don't matter, this falsehood that allows us to hate the other, to other the other. And we stand in the truth of Dharma, which is the truth of belonging and the truth of love and the truth of goodness that is stronger than anything that the world can offer us. Do you feel that? Do you feel that energy of love that is so much powerful, so much more powerful than some of the distress and distortion that is going on right now? There is something greater always. Love, unity, kindness, small acts, trust, God, peace. And when, as it says in the book, when our gifts, when focusing on our gifts, recognizing our gifts and our part to play in all of this, and our recognition that doing great acts in a small way is actually large, when those things intersect with the call of the times in service of others, that's when our Dharma is revealed and becomes powerful. And we can live in that knowing, we can live in that place, we can live in that power of knowing that we are on purpose and that we are making a difference. And so I hold that grace for each of us today, not only us, but the people that we touch with our goodness. I hold that for the entire world, knowing that we are blessed beyond our knowing. Let us pray.